Good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to our Mahashivaratri celebration. It's really nice to see all of you. So there are, at the moment, it looks like about 300 people with us from, I know, many, many places all over the world. And I want to just invite you to take the position, as it were, that in this meditation session on Shiva, we're going to move from the outside, from the expression of Shiva outwardly, which includes an expression of this nature of this celebration in its external form, in its celebratory form. And then we'll gradually take it inside into quiet meditation. You know, the quality of Shivaratri at the deepest level is of stillness, of silence, of deep quiet. And it is a holy night. It's the true silent night, I've always felt. But on the other hand, Mahashivaratri is a raucous celebration. It's a celebration. And so we're going to spend a few minutes at the beginning just tuning into the celebratory quality of Mahashivaratri. So this is a holiday that's like most of the great Indian holidays. It's based on the lunar calendar. Shivaratri takes place on the 14th day of the waning moon, the day before the new moon. And it's an all-night festival. So it begins on the day before the new moon, and then it segues into the new moon. And for devotees of Shiva, there are Shivaratri celebrations every month on the 14th day of the waning moon. But this is Mahashivaratri, the great Shivaratri. In the Hindu month of Phalguna, which corresponds to February, March in the Gregorian calendar. If you were doing the traditional Mahashivaratri vow, you would have been fasting today, and you would go on fasting until the celebration ends at around 7 a.m. tomorrow. And you might spend the evening, much of the evening, doing Abhisheka of a Shiva Lingam, if you happen to have one, or going to a tent. This is a Shiva Lingam. This is my Shiva Lingam. It's made of volcanic rock from the Big Island of Hawaii. And so you would do Abhisheka consisting of, Abhisheka means bathing, and you would create a sacred liquid made out of milk, water, ghee, honey or sugar, and cow's yogurt. And you would pour it with mantras at intervals over the Shiva Lingam, over and over and over again. So, and then at the auspicious hour, you would break the fast. And the idea, Shivaratri is a holiday that's said to give the fruit of liberation. My guru, who was a devotee of Shiva, used to encourage us to chant all night, and he would inspire us to do the chant by telling us, if you can stay completely alert and awake throughout the night, when morning comes, you'll be liberated. So it never actually happened for me that way. But what I did discover, and I think you'll discover, is that the grace, the shakti, the energy that pours through the atmosphere on this day is going to affect you. And it, in a certain sense, it's that chanting and telling stories of Shiva and remembering him, that it, whose name both means the ultimate goodness, and that which is the ground of everything. By remembering Shiva there's enormous internal cleansing that takes place. So we'll see how you experience it, but I can pretty much guarantee you that you will. So as everyone is gathering, I want to bring us back to the chant that we started to do at the beginning. Deb, can you put up the second slide? Yes, there we go. Okay, so this is a picture, a painting of Shiva as the wild yogi, and we'll say more about that in a few moments. But I want to, as I said, we are starting with the external, we're starting with the outside, and that one of the characteristics of Shiva is that he is known as the guru, also as the lord of yogis, the deity of yogis. And we're talking here not only about yogis who practice in comfortable circumstances, but especially those yogis who live in forests and lonely wild places. So there's a tradition in the city of Varanasi, which is a city sacred to Shiva. It's a holy city. It used to be known as Kashi, one of the oldest cities on the subcontinent. And it's been sacred to Shiva for thousands and thousands of years. And of the many Shiva temples in India, one of the most famous is the Vishwanath temple. And if you can imagine on this night, and it's happening now, no matter what time it is where we are, these wandering sadhus and holy men, many of them naked or wearing just a loincloth, smeared with ash, with matted locks like Shiva, with dreads, they come to the city, they come to Kashi, and they come to the Vishwanath temple. They march through town, through the city. They smoke a lot of ganja. They become very high and ecstatic. And they, as they flow around the city, they chant this chant. And we're going to spend a few minutes chanting it. It's one of my favorite chants. This is Krishna Das. And you can just throw yourself into it, fully go for it. The words are on the screen. Shambho.
Hey, Sally, your sound is not coming through very well.
Okay.
And I don't believe I've got the right.
I think it's the wrong mantra.
Yes, the mantra that you.
Okay, tell me what's going on.
I mean, the PowerPoint that you asked me to share.
Uh-huh.
I don't think it's got the right mantra.
That does. Oh, no, you're right. Okay. So, but could you hear it?
Not very well.
All right. Okay. So much for that. All right. So, God bless you. Sorry for my inability to fully understand the technicalities of sharing sound on the screen. It means we're going to do less chanting and more meditation. But let me just say a little bit about Shiva. Because I was essentially trained in a Shaiva tradition, my guru being a very hardcore Shaivite, one of his main teachings, which is of course the core teaching of Shiva and the core teaching of what this holiday is about, is that Shiva exists on many different levels. So Shiva is the wild yogi, this incredible countercultural figure. And so Deb, there is a slide with a painting of Shiva on his bull, riding his bull, which I'm hoping you can put on the screen. Yes, that one. This is one of the versions of Shiva in his wildness. And you see him carrying his trident, racing through the clouds on the back of the sacred bull. He's surrounded, you can see these figures riding with him through the clouds. They're goblins, they're ghosts, they're demonical figures. They're called his ganas or his host. And in this picture, you can see he's beyond the world. He's beyond any ideas of good or bad. He's beyond the human. He's beyond the divine. He's beyond everything. So Deb, you can take it off. Thank you. Shiva in this form lives in cremation grounds and on mountaintops. He's usually in meditation, but he comes out of meditation from time to time to dissolve worlds. And in the Hindu trinity of Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, of course, he's associated with the cosmic power of dissolution. He's the power that brings everything that exists into himself. So for us as meditators, Shiva is that power within us that dissolves thoughts. And this is an extremely significant aspect of him, and it's the reason why he's considered to be the deity of yogis. Because, for example, of the other two masculine deities in Hinduism, Brahma is in charge of creation. So if you think of all the things that you're drawn to create in your life, Brahma and his Shakti, Saraswati, are really the energies that allow us to manifest and create. Vishnu and his consort Lakshmi are the aspects of consciousness of the divine that sustain life. You know, so they're associated with wealth and beauty and fertility and, you know, the social order, the social and political order. Whereas Shiva and his consort Kali, who also has a gentle form known as Parvati, and many, many other goddess forms who are, as it were, branches of the tree of Kali, who is the fundamental feminine form of Shiva. And he, you know, in the lives of yogis, it is Shiva and Kali who draw us away from all of our entanglements in the world and bring us deeply into the heart, you know, literally connecting the intellect and the heart so that we can begin to experience ourselves as pure light or pure void. One of Shiva's names is Mahashunya. In many places, Shiva is considered to be a somewhat dangerous deity for householders to practice with, because what he tends to do is dissolve your household life. But that's only partly true, because there are many, many householders in India who worship Shiva and have wonderful household lives. So he is, in fact, a source of grace through all the circumstances of your life. Now, we've said already he's the guru, he's the eternal guru, whose teachings dissolve the mind of the meditator into the heart and reveal his true nature, which is Satchit Ananda. Satchit Ananda, if you know, when we talk about God in the ultimate, the absolute ultimate in Hindu philosophy, the absolute is usually referred to as Brahman, which means the immensity. But in Vedanta and in the deep meditative traditions, the absolute is known as Sat Chit Ananda, absolute awareness, absolute being, and absolute bliss or love. And this is what Shiva is. He's when all forms dissolve into the heart, you recognize yourself as Sat Chit Ananda. You exist. You are. Even in deep sleep, you exist, and you never do not exist. As a soul, you never do not exist. As a soul, you have the capacity to know whatever is to be known. This is Shiva. He has awareness that is present in all times, in all places, and in all things, in which at a certain stage in our evolution also becomes accessible to us through our intuition. And finally, the nature of Shiva is absolute blissfulness, Ananda. So my guru, when he gave the mantra Om Namah Shivaya, he would always say, Shiva is not a Hindu deity. Shiva is absolute consciousness. He is that which you are. Now, I'm going to say that Shiva is a Hindu deity. This is part of the beautiful paradox of this tradition. Shiva is both absolute consciousness, and he's the awareness that allows us to experience everything in our lives. So, and this is a very important understanding, by the way, which we'll get into a little bit later. Shiva is your awareness. Shiva is that in you, which is able to discern whatever you see through the eyes, whatever you hear through the ears, whatever you imagine in the mind. All of this is possible only because of awareness. And that awareness is the presence of Shiva. It's the presence of the absolute consciousness within us. Some of you are very aware of that. Some of you have experienced it. Some of you have experienced it for a moment and then lost touch with it. All of us, at some point in our practice, will come to realize, and this is what, you know, in the non-dual traditions we call realization, you will come to realize that who you are is that awareness. And that awareness is God, Shiva being the name that God is called in this tradition. So the worship of Shiva is the worship of your own awareness. And, you know, the great mantra of the hardcore yogis in many parts of India was Shiva Aham, Shiva Aham, Shiva Aham, I am Shiva, Shiva is me. So meaning my true self, my own awareness is not different from the absolute awareness, the vast ocean of awareness. And it, in Tantra, there, one of the kind of core instructions in Tantra is worship Shiva by becoming Shiva. In other words, realize that you are Shiva. And I've always, I mean, in my early years of practice, because I was practicing in a Shaiva tradition, we often would use this mantra in English, I am Shiva, or Shivaham, as a kind of assertion of our identity with the divine. And, you know, full disclosure, I never really believed it. I always felt like I was making an assertion, a statement that was not my experience. But one of the things that I came to realize, and again, I know that there are many of you here who have had this experience, is that when you practice meditation with one of Shiva's great mantras, what you come to recognize is that the mantra, after really transforming your consciousness, purifying your consciousness, sinking deeper and deeper into your consciousness, reveals itself to you as your own awareness, not only your own awareness, but your own mind. So we're going to practice tonight. We're going to practice with Om Namah Shivaya, with the understanding that, and we're going to practice Om Namah Shivaya because Om Namah Shivaya is what's called the Mula Mantra of Shiva. It's the root mantra. It's a mantra that anyone can practice, whether or not you've received initiation into it. It purifies all the elements in your physical and subtle bodies. And so one of the reasons why yogis in this tradition practice with Om Namah Shivaya, really from the beginning to the end of their sadhana, is because it will take your normal thought clogged, you know, perhaps slightly neurotic, suffering consciousness, the consciousness that is the everyday experience of a normal person, and will gradually transform it just by saying the mantra, internalizing the mantra, learning to identify with the mantra. It will transform your consciousness. It will literally reshape or the particles of your awareness, so that this teaching, this idea, you are Shiva and Shiva is you, meaning you are God and God is you. You are divine consciousness and divine consciousness is you. This becomes not a dogma, but an actual experience. And one of the classic ways to find this experience is through the mantra. So we're going to start with the mantra a little bit later in the class. We're going to be meditating on awareness itself, and you're welcome to do that right now if that's your preferred method of meditation. But for now, please sit up. You have my full permission to lie down for when I'm speaking, but when we're meditating, it's very important to sit up straight. And one reason for that is because we're going to be meditating with the central channel at a certain point, but we're going to begin in the heart. So close your eyes, inhale and feel the contact between your buttocks and the chair, the seat, the cushion. Exhale and begin to feel your spinal column and see if you can feel how the breath itself will help and allow the spinal column to elongate upwards, so that your torso naturally rises. You can let your shoulder blades come onto the back. Allow your chest to open. And take a big, deep breath. With the exhalation, allow the breath to take away the residue of the day, the feelings of restlessness that we sometimes have when we come into a practice. And then with another inhalation and another exhalation, feel yourself settling into this posture and allow your attention to come into the heart in the center of the chest, just behind the breastbone. And as you tune into the heart, you can allow the breath as it flows into the nostrils to flow downward to the heart. And then as the exhalation arises, just see if you can feel the breath flowing through the whole chest cavity. Just for a moment or two, feel the breath touching the heart, caressing the heart, bringing your attention to the energy within the heart center. Some of you might like to approach the heart. This is my favorite method, but it's particularly comfortable for some people. Feel that the chest opens as though there are a window or an opening in it, and the breath can flow in directly through the front of the heart, through the front of the breastbone, into the area of the inner body. And begin to feel as you practice with the breath, whether you're feeling it entering through the nostrils or entering through the front body. Feel that the inhalation takes your attention backwards to the back of the body, which is the abode of our more relaxed consciousness, of our parasympathetic nervous system, and the place from which it begins to be possible to experience our own heartful awareness as a universal awareness. Feel that in the middle of the heart, and you don't have to visualize it, you can simply feel its presence, is a thumb-shaped flame, perfectly still. This is one of the forms of the Shiva Lingam inside your body. And we're going to inhale with Om Namah, feeling these syllables flowing into the heart. And we'll exhale with Shivaya, feeling the vibratory resonance of the mantra and the breath flowing through the whole region of the heart. So let yourself practice with a lot of delicacy, almost as though the breath is whispering to you, Om Namah Shivaya, offering it into the flame of the heart. Om Namah as the offering of the inhalation, Shivaya as the recognition with the exhalation that the vibration of Shiva's consciousness is spreading through your heart, spreading through your torso. Inhaling Om Namah into the heart as an offering. Exhaling Shivaya. Take a deep breath in with Om Namah. Exhale fully with Shivaya. Like you can open your eyes. We'll be going in and out of meditation. We'll be meditating for longer in a few moments. So, one of the truths that I keep recognizing when I practice with the different forms of Shiva is the extraordinary significance of the lingam. As a, you know, the word lingam means sign. So the presence of the lingam is a sign of the presence of Shiva. And again, we're going to consider Shiva here in his ultimate form as the divine consciousness, which is the ground of everything, and as the ultimate goodness that lies beyond the dualities of good and bad and masculine and feminine and up and down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That fundamental realization of Shiva is that ultimately reality is good, reality is welcoming. And that welcoming goodness of reality is innate in us. It doesn't mean that goodness is natural to human beings. It's one of the paradoxes. Goodness is innate, but it's not natural. We don't come into the world mostly tuned into our own goodness. Most of us don't. We have to learn to find it, and we have to learn to act from it. But, you know, and that, of course, is the subject of ethics. But in the deepest truth of our being, we are that goodness. And the lingam, the presence of the lingam, is the sign that that ultimate goodness is present. So the flame in the heart is a form of the lingam. If you're familiar with the chakras, you know that there is a lingam in every one of the chakras, it's also true that the lingam is present in the physical world in many, many forms. In the first slide we showed, the kind of introductory slide, there's a lingam that is actually a rocket. It's a rocket taking off. And I think we all are very aware that when Elon Musk sends his rockets into space, that rocket looks like a giant phallus. You know, that thrusting, rising form of the rocket, of the fountain, you know, this fundamentally linga-shaped form is always moving between the worlds. Yes, thank you, Beth. There it is. So this is one form of the lingam, and once we start recognizing the presence of the lingam and seeing it as what it is, we start to see it everywhere. The feminine form, the yoni, in which the lingam rests, is of course in the shape of the female yoni, the female vagina. And so the coupling of the Shiva, of the lingam and the yoni, is a profoundly mystical coupling, and yes, it is heteronormative based on human biology or based on mammalian biology. Most creatures, in order to give birth, bring together the seed of the masculine and the seed of the feminine. And so the religious traditions, or at least the Shaiva tradition, Shaiva and Shakta traditions, recognize this as really the heart of the world and the symbol of this world that comes out of the coupling of the divine Shiva and the divine Shakti. So there's a story about the lingam which goes to its mystical significance. And the story goes that one time back in the day, when the worlds were not yet born, Vishnu, the great sustaining power, is asleep on the ocean of consciousness, supported by the great serpent Shesha. And he's dreaming endless dreams, endless universes. And Brahma, the creator, sees this beautiful being on the ocean, and he goes up to him and he says, "Who are you?" So Vishnu opens his eyes and says, "Welcome, my child." Brahma says, "Who are you calling my child?" "I'm Brahma. I'm the creator of the world. Who do you think you are?" Vishnu says, "I'll tell you who I am. I am Vishnu. I am Narayan. I'm the eternal, undying source. I'm the divine masculine incarnate. And you were born from my body," he says, which is true. And they get into a furious argument about who's the true deity. And suddenly a pillar of fire appears, and it's shining with the light of 1,000 suns, and it's utterly vast, it's awe-inspiring, it's scary. And it doesn't seem to have an end, it doesn't seem to have a beginning. So Vishnu and Brahma look at each other in wonder, and they say, "Well, let's find out where it comes from and where it ends." So Vishnu takes the form of a boar, a tusk, a wild pig, a tusked pig, and dives into the center of the earth looking for the base of the lingam. Brahma takes the form of a swan, which is the vehicle of his consort, and flies up into the heavens. They both, Vishnu burrowing, Brahma flying, they travel for 1,000 years, and neither of them are able to find the beginning or the end of the lingam. So Vishnu comes back to the place on the milky ocean. Brahma comes back. They shall now know how to meet each other. Vishnu says, "I can't find the beginning of it anywhere." And Brahma lies. Brahma has a bit of an ego. He's got the artist's ego. And he says, "I found it. It's, it's way up there. I had to travel a long way, but I found it. I found the place where this pillar of fire ends." And all of a sudden there was a sound arose from inside the lingam. And this voice said, "Brahma, you're lying. There is no beginning and end. This is the form of the absolute. This is the source of all that is." So, and with the sound Om, which is the signifier, the sound signifier of Shiva, he cured the delusion of Brahma and Vishnu. And the story goes that because Vishnu was able to admit that he could not find the source of all that is, he became a major, of course, major deity who sustained the worlds. Whereas Brahma, who continued to do his work of evolving universes, Brahma has never really been worshipped in India. His consort, Saraswati, is worshipped, but Brahma has no temples. And in this, in the sort of esoteric understanding of this myth, Brahma represents the mind, which is, as we all know, the ultimate trickster and can never really admit any power greater than itself. Whereas Vishnu represents the heart, where the mind can actually take rest and the heart is capable of realizing that which is greater than itself. So in other words, the heart represents the power of surrender. The mind basically will never surrender unless we befriend it. And the way we befriend it pretty much is with mental. So all over India, there are linga. They're called Jyotir linga, meaning linga of light. And very often they simply appear naturally. There's you know, many of you know this. There's a linga in Chidambaram in South India that has no form. It's made of space. So when you go to that temple and you go for darshan of the linga, there's a big statue of Shivanataraj. And then the priest will say, okay, now you're going to have darshan. They pull back a curtain on the side of the main altar. There's nothing there. It's pure space. But the energy that flows from it nearly knocks you over. So in other words, it's a invisible form of Shiva in that temple. There's a linga made of ice in North India in a cave called Amarnath in the Himalayas, which has now become a major pilgrimage spot to the point where the linga appears in the winter every year. And it's always been an incredibly difficult and dangerous pilgrimage to get there. Nowadays, they've made it much easier. And as a result, there are thousands of pilgrims who go there. So many that the ice lingam melts every year. So, but rise, you know, and the lingam that is the most significant for us is the central channel, which runs, of course, from the perineum, the base of the body, up through the center of the spinal column, up through the crown, ultimately connecting us to the highest realms of divinity and to the center of the earth below. And, you know, again, this is not news to many of you, that at the base of the lingam, of the central channel, lies the coiled Kundalini Shakti, the liberating force that rests within us until the moment comes to wake us up, and at which point this coiled light enters into the central channel and begins to rise through the body, purifying and opening us at every single level of consciousness. So we're going to spend a few moments now meditating on the central channel, connecting the base of the body with the crown. And this is one of the reasons why we want you to sit up straight. See if you can find the perineum. It's between the anus and the sexual organ at the base of the penis in a man and at the base of the yoni in a woman. Feel that from this base, we're going to do this meditation in front of the spinal column for the moment, because it's generally easier for us to find it. And it's also accurate and significant. So imagine that from the perineum up through the center of the body, just in front of the spinal column, and for some of you, it might feel very comfortable to feel it inside the spinal column. It's up to you. Feel it rising like a slender channel of light up through the center of the belly, the solar plexus, through the region behind the heart, up through the base of the throat, to the center of the head, and the central channel ultimately is experienced rising through the crown, rising into realms of light that some of you may have experienced, and which it's my hope that we all experience at some time. And at the base of the lingam, the base of the Sushumna Nadi, the central channel, it flows down into the center of the earth, which is actually a region of molten fire, the fire at the core of the earth. I discovered, to my surprise, actually is fairly close to the surface. It's about 5 miles into the earth. You come to this region of fire, which is, of course, the fire that flows through volcanoes. So the lingam is deeply connected to the energy at the center of the earth and to the light realms beyond the earth plane, beyond the heavenly planes. But for now, we're going to simply experience it within our bodies. So make your seat firm, feeling the connection of the buttocks to the seat, feeling the spinal column elongating upward from the space, allowing the chest to open. You're going to meditate with Om Namah Shivaya. And if there's another mantra that you're used to practicing with, you're very, very free to practice with your usual mantra. Inhaling, feel the breath touching the area around the perineum. Exhaling, feel the breath rising up from that grounded base up into the heart. Inhaling, feel the breath flowing into the heart. Exhaling, feel it flowing up this central column, up to the center of the head, the Ajna Chakra, which is located above the soft palate, half an inch towards the center of the head. So let's find and establish ourselves in the central channel. Inhaling down to the region around the perineum. Exhaling to the heart. Inhaling to the heart. Exhaling up to the center of the head. It's very good if you could actually feel the breath touching the region around the perineum. I'll tell you a secret, because most of us don't have a deep enough breath to feel the breath touching it. Instead, touch that region with your awareness, so that as you inhale, you're inhaling with awareness of the area around the perineum. And then as you exhale, exhale with the awareness that the energy of the central channel flows up from there, up through the center of the belly, through the solar plexus into the heart. And the exhalation centers your awareness in the heart. The next inhalation, you feel the breath flowing up into the center of the head. And then with the inhalation, let your attention come down to the perineum and we'll begin the process again. I'll give instructions for a few minutes and let you sink into it. And then we're going to meditate for a little longer this time, so you have a chance to really feel your way into the central channel. And we're going to add the mantra. So with the inhalation, Om Namah. In the region of the perineum, Shivaya, the exhalation of the heart. Om Namah, inhaling into the heart, Shivaya, exhaling up to the center of the head. Om Namah, inhaling into the region around the perineum, exhaling, feeling this thread, this column of awareness and light flowing up just in front of the spinal column, into the heart of Shiva. Inhaling to the heart of the mind. Exhaling as you feel the central channel connecting the heart to the center of the head with Shiva. Om Namah. With the inhalation, Shivaya, with the exhalation, from the perineum to the heart, the center of the head. See if, as you take a deep breath in and let it out very gently and with a lot of relaxation, see if you can continue to feel the presence of the channel, of the cord, the central pillar, which is the lingam within your body, going from the perineum up through the center of the head. For some of you, it may be possible to experience the base of the lingam flowing down into the earth and flowing up through the crown. And it's fine if you just feel it as the central pillar of your body, around which everything in your physical and subtle bodies is organized. Just as the spinal cord carries all the messages that we need in order to live our lives, in the same way, the Sushumna Nadi, the central channel, the inner lingam, carries all the subtle coding that makes us what we are. And the power within the central channel affects the physical body, but is way deeper and subtler than the physical body, carrying within it both the karmas and the gifts of all your lifetimes. And its nature is Shiva. Deb, can you put on the slide of the yogi in the Himalayas? Yes. This is the classic form of Shiva in as Shankara, as the peaceful one. This is Shiva as the meditating yogi, and in this painting, he's looking directly at us. And I'm just going to say a little bit about the iconography. Shiva is filled with paradoxes. Now, on one level, he's a complete recluse. He's totally separate from the world. He's unfindable and unknowable. On another level, he's the consort of Parvati, who is not only a loving wife, but an erotic partner. So he's both a completely detached yogi and a husband and lover, who in that form is known as Kameshwari, which means the lord of pleasure, the lord of love, not only the love that creates universes, but also the love that manifests in through our sexual desires. He wears on his head a crescent moon, which is, of course, the symbol of the goddess. And coming out of his jata, his matted locks, is this stream of blue, which represents the river Ganga. And the story goes that Ganga was a celestial river which came to earth because of the prayers and the tapas, the meditative ardor of a great king in immeasurably ancient times. But she was afraid to fall hard on the earth. She had to come from such a great distance. So Shiva offered to hold her in his crown, in his jata, make her fall so that she could come to the earth safely. Around his neck is a coiled cobra. And there's a story about that, which we'll get to in a few, we're going to tell that story for, in a few moments. The cobra represents Kundalini, the serpent power, as she's sometimes called, which looks like a snake made of light and coiled. You can see that Shiva's snake is coiled three times. He carries a trident, which represents the sacred number three, and it has many meanings, but let's say it refers to the physical body, the subtle body, the causal body, to the waking state, the dream state, the deep sleep state, to the earth plane, the middle astral realms, the celestial planes, to the three deities, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva himself. And you see this trident carried not only by Shiva, but by the goddesses who are representations or forms of Shiva's consort. In the hand, I guess it's his left hand, opposite our right hand, he carries a damaru, a drum, which is constantly sending out vibrations, vibratory resonances. And it's these vibrations that manifest as the universe. So the drum is this instrument of creativity that represents the power of sacred sound to manifest the world. This is, of course, an entire science that's very much described in the tantras, which, of course, we're not going to go into now. He's wearing a tiger skin. There's a story about that, which we'll talk about in a moment as well. And the most significant thing for me about this iconographic image of Shiva, there's two aspects of it which I want to draw your attention to. One is his upraised hand, which is in the mudra, the Abhaya mudra, which means fear not. There's a beautiful sacred story of the Inuit people in which talks about a deity named Sila, whose sacred mantra is be not afraid of the universe. And this is what Shiva is saying with his upraised hand, be not afraid of the universe. I am here within all of it. And in the center of his forehead is his third eye, which is the eye of wisdom, the eye of discernment, the eye that can see through all the forms of this world to the blazing light that's at the heart of it. And of course, one of the very famous stories about Shiva is how fire comes out of his third eye and incinerates the god Kama, who's been, inciting him to seduce his soon-to-be consort, Parvati. And as a result of this, Kama, the god of physical love, is bodiless. And therefore, able to more or less come into any situation without being impaired by a physical body. And it's very significant. And it's one of the things that I've always taken very much to heart about Shiva as a form of consciousness, is that he is both a being of ultimate discernment who sees through every delusion, every illusion. He's also a being of profound erotic ecstasy. And when we use the term erotic ecstasy, we're not talking about genital sexuality. We're talking about the absolute ecstasy that arises in us when we begin to recognize what is behind all this. So, okay, here I am back again. His body is smeared with sacred ash, which comes from the fires with which he dissolves the world. And he wears a necklace of Rudraksha beads. Rudraksha beads, which are named after one of his sacred names, Rudra, are said to represent the tears that he sheds when he experiences and sees the suffering of the world. So these take form as the seed of a tree called the Rudraksha, which of course yogis and probably many of you wear around your neck, which are protective, which are a sign of Shiva's presence. He has several forms, and I'm just going to mention some of them. One of his earliest forms is Rudra. Rudra's name means the howler. And Rudra is a shamanic, wrathful hunter-gatherer figure. And you know that painting that we showed earlier of Shiva on his bull riding through the heavens is actually, yes. Oh, well, that's a good one too. Yeah, thank you, Deb. This is Rudra. Another of his forms is Bhairava, which we don't have a picture of Bhairava, but Bhairava is a very wrathful form who also is the source of some of the great non-dual scriptures. He has many names, 1,000 names, and he also, of course, is most famously known as Nataraja, the divine dancer. And Deb, can you see the painting of, okay, after that? Yes, that one. So I think this must come from a comic book, but I love it because it really illustrates what this story that I'm about to tell you. So I just got a note saying that from someone who says she's having a hard time hearing. Is that true for everybody? Are we okay in terms of sound? So we're okay in terms of sound.
Yeah, we've got some whooshing in the back. I thought maybe your air purifier.
No, I don't have an air purifier.
Okay.
Maybe it's the sound of the, let me just turn up the sound. Okay, is this better?
Your computer, yeah.
Okay, is this better?
It's a little bit better.
Okay.
But you're using your mic on your laptop, right?
Right.
Yeah. Oh.
Okay. So here's the story about Nataraja. I know that many of you know this story. The reason I want to tell it is because it is actually one of the real messages of this tradition. And okay, wait a second. I'm just going to close out my music program, which might be the problem. So there was a group of sages living in a forest, and they were doing an incredibly elaborate fire ritual sacrifice with the hope of gaining control of the entire universe. And they represented a particular tendency, a particular trend in Indian spirituality, which is actually a widespread human trend, which was the belief that if you do the right actions, if you do the right things, that you can gain your goals purely through the power of your mind and your actions. And Shiva is watching this sacrifice, which is actually extremely powerful and which is threatening to the world, sort of like what Vladimir Putin is doing in Ukraine. There is a lot of parallels in our lives throughout human history about what happens when people gain a lot of power and believe that they can have the capacity to control the world. So Shiva is watching these sages, and he realizes that they are completely missing. They have lost the plot. In other words, they're supposed to be priests. They're supposed to be spiritual practitioners, but they've become utterly enmeshed in their own collective, their group ego, and their ambitions and their desires and their pride of their technical skill at the practices that they're doing. So he calls Vishnu his friend and whispers in his ear. Vishnu agrees, and the two of them descend into the forest. Shiva takes the form of an incredibly beautiful naked yogi, absolutely buck naked, not a stitch of clothing. Every part of his body is radiant, blazing with light. Vishnu takes his form, the form of Mohini, which Mohini's name means the enchanting one. And being Vishnu, he is the most beautiful woman that has ever been seen on earth. The two of them just saunter into the forest, walk up to the site of the yajna, catch everybody's eye. Of course they do. They're divine. You know, they're alluring beyond any form of allurement. And all the wives of the sages are drawn towards Shiva as though by a magnet. And then he runs off into the forest and they run after him, their clothes coming off their bodies. You know, they're completely mad with love and lust for Shiva. In the meantime, the sages themselves have fallen for the Mohini form of Vishnu, and they abandon the sacrifice, and they too are off chasing after Vishnu. So there is now complete chaos in the forest. The sacrifice has been totally disrupted. And suddenly the sages all realize, more or less at the same moment, that they've been tricked. And in fury, they come back to the fire and they begin to attack Shiva. So they throw, you know, the first thing they do is manifest a snake out of the fire, which they throw at Shiva. He grabs the snake, he slits its skin from its body with one of his fingernails, wraps the snake skin around his neck. They conjure out of the fire an evil dwarf known as Apasmara. And Apasmara is the demon of forgetfulness. So he is that force which makes us forget our origins. And the dwarf lunges at Shiva. Shiva again grabs him, places him under his foot. You know, and you see this on the images of Shiva. He's standing on the head of Apasmara, whom he's conquered, whom he's placed under his foot. And then they throw the fire at him. And Shiva, of course, grabs the fire in his hand. And then he begins to dance. And can we see, Deb, can we see the slide again? So he begins to dance. Thank you. Okay, that'll do. He begins to dance. And as he dances, the entire cosmos begins to shake. There is a form of Indian dance, Bharatanatyam. It's a very famous dance, and it's Shiva's dance, the dance of Nataraja. And the women who dance, they're usually young girls, they have anklets, and they're barefooted, and they slap their feet on the ground. And their anklets jangle, and it, you know, this represents the way the worlds shake as Shiva dances. And in the dance, the sages see worlds being born, sustaining for a while, and then dissolving. And the sages realize that what they are watching, it's the true story of this universe, which arises out of the movements of the supreme, of the divine. And they all fall on their knees, fall on their faces in front of Shiva, and are cured of their arrogance and become knowers of this truth, that the divine dance encompasses every aspect of our life. So we're going to do for a moment an internal recognition of the dance of Shiva. But first, I just want to point to the significance. Can you bring it back? Deb, can you bring it back? Thank you. So again, this iconography is very famous. And it represents what's called Shiva's fivefold act. Shiva's fivefold act, and there's an entire scripture in this, which we obviously are not going to go into today. Shiva's fivefold act encompasses the creation, which is the manifestation of worlds, the manifestation of everything from the universe arising out of the Big Bang to thoughts arising in your mind. The raised palm, the Abhaya Mudra palm, represents sustenance, the power of sustenance, which maintains things for a certain amount of time. The fire represents dissolution, in which energy is not dissolved, but taken back into its source. Remember, energy is ever-existent. It doesn't die. It simply returns to its source. And these three acts, creation or manifestation, sustenance and dissolution, account for pretty much everything that goes on in the physical and subtle realms. The other two acts, concealment and grace, are the esoteric aspects of Shiva. And they're, in a sense, the ones that most concern us. The downturned hand, it's in a mudra called Dola Mudra, which is called the mudra of concealment. And through Dola Mudra, Shiva conceals the presence of the divine in the world. He conceals the fact that this entire universe is contained in the ground of his being, constantly manifesting through the activity of his Shakti. But that hand, the Dola Mudra, points to the dancing foot, which represents grace. And here in this tradition, grace is the power that helps us in whatever way we need help. But on a deeper level, grace is the ultimate revelation in which we're able to recognize the presence of the divine in ourselves and ultimately in the world. So someone asked the question, are the blue bodies representing? Shiva is shown here as blue, which is the color in which many of the Krishna is also shown as blue. My understanding of Shiva actually is that he's white. Because of the ash that covers his body. But divine bodies are blue. In case of Kali, a very dark blue, blue-black. In the case of Shiva, a very pale, or Krishna, very pale blue. And that blue is the color of the inner lights that we begin to see when our awareness arises into the upper chakras. We begin to see washes of blue light. We can sometimes see a tiny blue dot called the Nila Bindu, the blue dot or the blue pearl, which actually holds the form of Shiva in the human body. This is an esoteric truth so far out that you actually have to experience it to believe it. And this recognition of our bodies and minds as not just the mirrors of Shiva, but as the individual expressions, the microcosmic expressions of the divine, is given to us through grace, through the anugraha shakti, the shakti of self-revelation. And our entire spiritual life is held in grace and is made possible by grace. So I'd like to invite you to perform the act of grace for yourself at this moment. I often like to say that what we could call cosmic grace is the gift of awakening that comes from Shiva. It's called Shaktipat. And there's Shaktipat is another big subject, but ultimately Shaktipat is the descent of revelation from the divine, which I'm acting as though it's coming down, but actually it can come up because remember the divine is everywhere. So that's the act of cosmic grace is the act of awakening that comes as a blessing from the divine. And it's often experiences coming from outside yourself because most of us for a long time continue to see the divine as being outside ourselves. It actually takes a lot of practice and a lot of grace to begin to realize that the divine is you. But there's also what I like to call individual grace, personal grace, which is the process that we allow ourselves when we begin to recognize our normal daily processes of life as part of Shiva's act of creation, dissolution, and sustenance. In other words, when we can start to realize that our bodies and minds are part of the dance of Shiva, and that everything that's happening in the world, including the craziness that many of us are so concerned about, and for good reason, all of this is also the dance of Shiva, the dance of creation, sustenance, dissolution, creation of worlds, creation of humans, creation of animals, creations of societies, creations of cultures, their sustenance and their dissolution. And these processes are always going on. So again, firm your posture. Close your eyes. See if you can become aware of the central column, the lingam of light that runs through the center of your body, and breathing up and down the central column. Allow your attention to settle where it most comfortably can, perhaps in the heart, perhaps in the region behind the eyebrows, between the eyebrows and the center of the head, or perhaps just flowing with the breath. The breath flows in with Om Namah, flowing from the perineum to the heart if you're meditating with the column of light, and then from the heart to the center of the head, or perhaps flowing directly into the heart and expanding through the body. Just let yourself be in the flow of the breath and the mantra in the simplest way, the most comfortable way that appears to you in this moment. So as you anchor your attention with the breath, and as you allow the mantra to soften and open your consciousness, consider your body and your life and the world as a dance, an ever-changing, ever-moving, ever-transforming divine play. The cells in your body are dancing in an endless movement of change and transformation, cells being born, sustaining for a while, and then dissolving. Day dances into night, the phases of the moon succeed each other, the earth turns and the seasons change. Above all, your thoughts are arising, staying for a while, and then dissolving. And so as you allow the mantra to flow in and flow out, see if you can actually watch the thoughts as they arise and subside. And when I say watch, I don't mean that you have to see them. I'm just suggesting that you can become aware of them. So the rise and fall of thoughts inside the mind is your microcosmic experience of the creation, sustenance, and dissolution. That is the core of this world. So if you can be the observer of the play of thoughts, just noticing them come up and dissolve. And one of the ways that it's perhaps skillful to do this is to station yourself at the back of the heart, behind the heart, or behind the head, by bringing your awareness behind the body. You take a step backward from your normal outgoing consciousness. And from this place, allow yourself to observe what's going on in your body, what's going on in your mind, with the feeling that what you're watching is an infinitely subtle dance. Thoughts, feelings, moods arising and subsiding. Shiva is living inside you as the witness of all this. And he's also in the form of Shakti, being all this. So let yourself be Shiva, be awareness, be the witnessing presence. This is not simple mindfulness. This is actually a divine realization. You are that witness, which is your true self, which is Shiva. And because thoughts are so alluring and so tricky and so all-pervasive, they hide the one who knows your thinking. And yet, every moment, every fragment of a moment, when you can be the witness, even if for 5 seconds or 10. You are being Shiva. And ultimately, you can come to realize that the whole play of life is an entertainment that is being offered to this witnessing consciousness of Shiva by his gorgeous, beloved power known as Shakti. What we call Shiva's dance is the erotic lovemaking of consciousness with its power, of awareness and breath. And this is Shiva's teaching. You are that witnessing consciousness, and within you, this entire world is taking place. And as you come to know that more and more deeply, not only does it bring you peace, not only does it bring you wisdom, but it brings you ecstasy. So in our last moments together, Deb, can you bring up the picture of Shiva in the sitting in the Himalayas? Thank you. No, the other one, darling. Yes, that one. No, I'm sorry, that I'm wrong. It's the seated one. Yes, that one. Thank you. So notice that in this painting, he's looking directly at you. And we're going to do a practice. It's a classic deity practice in which we learn to take in the form of the divine as grace, through a meditative sense that we are being loved and enlivened by this presence. So allow yourself to look into Shiva's face, into his eyes. And as you do so, consider if there's something that you would like to ask. And when I say that you'd like to ask, I'm talking about a gift, an insight, a realization, an experience. What in this moment feels like a significant request that you can make of the divine on this night, when grace is so fully arising in the atmosphere? Maybe it's something very simple. Maybe it's a wish for peace. Maybe it's a wish for a big, grand wish. Or maybe it's something very personal. It doesn't matter. Shiva, well, one of his names is Ashutosha, which means the one who's easily pleased. So Shiva is all about offering you what it is that you want and need. You just have to know that he's the source. So as you look into his eyes, formulate your request. Imagine yourself placing your wish, your desire, your prayer in a flower. Shiva especially likes white flowers. So it could be a lotus or a rose or a branch of jasmine. Feel yourself placing your wish in that flower and offer the flower to Shiva's foot, his foot that rests on the mountaintop. And then bring your hands into Anjali Mudra and say thank you. Now you can do this next part with your eyes open or closed. You might want to start with your eyes open and then close them. We're going to allow ourselves to receive the grace of Shiva in the form of three rays of light. One that comes from his third eye, one that comes from his heart, and one that comes from his perineum, from his sacred phallus, if you will. So your eyes are closed. And though you can't see the painting, you remember it. Feel that Shiva's third eye opens and sends a gentle blaze of sparkling white light into the space of your own third eye. Feel that light bathing your brain, removing the residue of old thoughts and beliefs, renewing all the cells of your brain, flowing down through your neck and through the spinal cord. And you find your awareness in the heart. You become aware that Shiva's heart, Shiva's vast heart, has opened like the shutter of a camera, and a radiant blue light, an exquisitely delicate and bliss-filled blue light, is flowing from his heart into your heart. As you inhale, feel the light of Shiva's grace flowing into your heart. And as you exhale, offer that grace, that light back to him. And bring your attention down to the base of your body, to the area around the perineum. And become aware that this region in Shiva's light body is the very source of the grace that can transform your body mind, your karmic mind, your entire sense of presence on this earth, and feel that a deep red light, which is the light of Shiva's embodied Shakti, is flowing from this region of his body into yours, and feel that it fills your entire lower body, your pelvic region, your genitals, flowing down into your calves and knees, into your feet. Breathe it in as radiance, as strength, as divine power. and breathe it back to him. So that there are these three streams of divine light flowing into your body as gifts of grace from Shiva and as offerings back to him. The white light that flows from his third eye into yours, enlivening and rejuvenating and divinizing your brain. The blue light that flows from his heart to yours, igniting bliss and compassion, which even if you don't feel it at this moment, is going to take root in you through the grace of this night. And from Shiva's root, from his base, the red light of power and strength and life force flowing into the root of your own body and irradiating your entire lower body with health and strength and the exquisite power of your true nature. And just sit for a moment. Inhale the grace-filled lights that are flowing into you. Exhale them back, feeling, if you can, the unbreakable connection between the macrocosm and the microcosm, between the divine yogi, who is the source of this world, and you. And I'm going to, as we bring this time together to a close, I'm going to suggest that you spend some time tonight allowing this grace to cook within you, sitting with the mantra, simply feeling Shiva's presence and allowing yourself to inhale grace, or meditating on pure awareness, or on the mantra, or all of these, and allow yourself to fully bathe in the grace that is flowing through the universe on Shivaratri. Thank you so much for being here. The recording will be available in the next couple of days. Have a wonderful rest of your evening or your day. And may our practice be of benefit to all beings, and especially to those beings who are suffering in Eastern Europe. Namaste.